My name is Jill Whitman, and I teach at Pacific Lutheran University, and I teach geology there. And I can't think of a better setting in which to talk about geology than up here. We all get to see and experience it. I know Merle's a retired pastor doing Bible study. How about you?
Bob Burke. I know nothing about geology, except I have walked quite a bit on the earth.
Lots of observations. And you're a third grade teacher, so...
Well, I was. I retired.
Do lots of different things. In those classes, you do.
Huh?
You do all different subjects in a third grade class.
Oh, yes. I had everything with it. My cupboards, I had the children take and put all the books in their desks so that the cupboards could hold rocks and fossils.
That's wonderful.
And I'd bring them back. There wasn't any place to hide them.
Wonderful.
And the custodian didn't like the idea of cleaning up after.
And then those of you, Evelyn is in the back, and Evelyn is also a geologist. How else do you describe yourself?
No, I'm not.
A geographer who loves geology.
But I've lived long enough to have seen a time when you studied something about geology and they didn't mention it except as a wild theory. So in my life, I've seen the development of the acceptance of the general idea of plate tectonics happening. So that's been really interesting to follow, and of course I try to keep on it.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say you lived long enough to see the tectonic plate move.
Well, I have seen where they move.
That's right.
I mean, in a number of places.
That was a big controversy for a lot.
It is, and in fact, my intention, sort of in my talks over the week, is to go from fairly general to talking more specifically about this area in some of my sessions. And I love to talk about plate tectonics. It's not the area in which I've done a tremendous amount of research, but it is such a wonderful way to kind of pull together our view of the Earth. And I actually had my first encounter in a real geology class in 1970 when I was starting high school. And I was taught by a teacher who, even though plate tectonics had emerged as a theory in the mid-1960s, who was adamantly in disbelief of it, despite being a fairly youthful guy who had just come out of school himself. But I had the great fortune in going off as an undergraduate to a college that there was all sorts of activity going on in terms of exploring this new theory and looking at applications of it. So it was very easy to get caught up in it. And I love teaching it as an example to students of how a theory evolves, how we start out with one view of the Earth, and how that view changes with the more information which is acquired over time, and how as we collect this information or data, we discover that it doesn't support any longer the previous theories that we've believed in. And so I'm going to do a little bit of that, talk about some of this data, this evidence, to support the theory and some of it in terms of sort of historically when it was first collected, and then talk about sort of this worldview of the Earth and what some of the processes are that are happening and how we can then explain some of the natural phenomena that we see around us. So I'm going to spend most of the time with slides on. Now we've all just had a coffee break and eaten, right? And I hope that it won't be too dark. The worst time of day to teach a class is 1 in the afternoon at school. All those full stomachs just want to go to sleep. Yes, this is Mount St. Helens, and I just put this picture up as a sort of reminder of how very active our Earth is. And that's one of the beauties of the theory of plate tectonics is we've really come to realize that we don't have a static Earth. We have an Earth where things are constantly changing. As I said, this theory first emerged in the mid-1960s, in many ways the result of terrifically good fortune, of sort of the right people happening to be in the right place together to share some of their ideas. When we look back at this a little bit historically, we'll see that other people had previously tried to put forth similar earlier versions of the theory, and had been shot down because of the lack of support from other members within the scientific community. Well, basically, we'll come back and look at this in some detail, but basically, if we look at the theory just in brief, what it says is that the Earth is covered by a series of pieces that we call plates, which are a very thin layer compared to the entire Earth. But they're composed of very rigid material, and so an entire plate will move as an entire piece. Geologically, what's really interesting aren't the plates, but are where the plates meet at what we call the plate boundaries. And this is a map that shows us the plates. They're named. I'm sure you have trouble reading them from back there because the printing is fairly small, but the names of the plates generally refer to geographic features that are there. So, for example, we're living on the North American plate. Interestingly, the North American plate, though, includes not only the continent of North America, but includes some of the oceanic crust that makes up the northern part of the Atlantic. Similarly, we have a South American plate, an African plate, an Antarctic plate. Some of the plates that have been much harder to study are those which are almost entirely oceanic crust, such as the Pacific plate here, or the Nazca and Cocos plate. A plate of particular interest to us, and one we'll come back and talk about, is this very small plate here called the Juan de Fuca plate. We can look and see that we have, for example, a very large plate here in the north called the Eurasian plate. When we talk about it a little bit later on, we'll look at some of what's going on in a couple of areas there. But it hasn't always been a single plate. There's very good geologic evidence to suggest that at the Ural Mountains, we once could have separated it into two different plates. The boundaries, though, are where the things really happen. The symbols on this map represent different types of boundaries, and I'll be coming back and talking about them. But basically, the ones that they've outlined in blue here are boundaries where the plates are coming together, and the ones that have sort of this stair step appearance are the boundaries where the plates are separating. And those are the places where we have geologic activity that we're aware of, like volcanoes erupting or earthquakes, but also where we have more subtle, slower processes occurring as well. The real reason for the emergence of this theory in the 1960s is World War II. The technology which was developed during World War II for that new form of warfare using submarines required having a much better understanding of the seafloor. And in order to do that, all sorts of technology was developed to study the seafloor, and that technology was then transferred and the information gained from it into the scientific realm for those who were interested in learning more about the two-thirds of the Earth that are ocean floor, to be able to have a sense of what was going on there and pull a more complete picture together about the Earth. It's still a theory, though, plate tectonics. It's not fact. It certainly is presented as fact some places where one reads about it, but it's just a theory that seems well supported by the data and we can use to explain so much. That doesn't mean, however, that my grandchildren will be believing in this theory. And Evelyn's comment earlier is that she's seen the birth of this theory. For years previous to the mid-1960s, the geologic community had a very different theory that they believed in to explain the origin of mountain ranges. But this is our current theory, and as we see today, it works real well to explain a lot of the features that we see. What I want to do is just back up and talk a little bit about some of the evidence to support it. The first person who put forth in a very large document the suggestion that the continents had once all been together and had moved apart was a German scientist named Alfred Wegener, who's actually a meteorologist very interested in high latitude climates. He had met an early death in Greenland on an expedition there. But in looking at high latitude climates, he had also looked at ancient evidence for high latitude climates. In particular, the fact that all of the southern continents appeared to have experienced glaciation a number of hundred million years ago. And he said, boy, it's real interesting, all these separate little continents, when they all experienced it. How did we connect them up? Well, he collected a lot of other data at the same time. He looked at a lot of other kinds of climatic data and found that on the continents of North America and Eurasia and Africa and South America, there were all sorts of climate data which seemed to suggest that the continents hadn't always been in the positions that we find them today. For example, here we see tropical evidence in the fossil record for tropical climates here, and yet we know today, this is basically the eastern coast of North America, that that isn't in the tropics. Now, what this map shows is a reconstruction of the continents back together again, and one of the other things that Wegener noticed was that the pieces seem to fit together, not just this climatic data, but when he looked at fossil evidence, the distribution of organisms, finding that the same species had existed on South America and Africa 300 million years ago. How does one explain that when those continents are separated now by many thousand miles? Those are organisms that are too big to have been carried by a bird, too big to have been blown there, and weren't capable of swimming that distance. And again, when he started looking at the distribution of various fossils, whether they were land-based animals or plants, he found that the pieces looked like they fitted together. And actually, the analogy that he gave is one of a torn newspaper. There was some information on one continent and information on another continent, and not only did the pieces look like they'd been torn apart, but when you put them together, the story became a continuous one. And just another reconstruction that shows how these continents might have fit together. Wegener proposed the supercontinent of Pangaea and said Pan for all and Gaea for land, so all lands as a single continent. And he put forth very specific data to support this. The problem was he really didn't have a mechanism to explain it. He said the continents must have just plowed through the oceans in their movement to their present-day positions. There wasn't a very good process that anyone could explain, use to explain that, and so the result was that his books, which were published in the early part of this century, about 1915, all ended up on the shelves in libraries, covered with dust and basically ignored. And he was sort of drummed out of the scientific community for that theory. So everything really went on the back burner, and it wasn't until the Second World War that various sorts of data were collected, and really one of the most phenomenal sets of data that was collected was simply a sense of the depth and shape of the seafloor. Now, this is a map that it's an artist's creation. It is not as we look at topographic maps on land, we have a pretty good sense that they're accurate. When we look at these in the oceans, what we're relying upon are many single data points collected together to put together this picture. But from this, in the late 1950s, emerged a map that looks something like this, where scientists together with an artist had created something to represent the major features on the seafloor. And one of the major features that we see is some mountain range. It rises from the seafloor. It doesn't rise above sea level, but it rises very dramatically from the lower surrounding seafloor up as what we call a ridge. And also, there were some very deep features noted. Very narrow, arcuate shape, great depth features that have been called trenches. And these features suggested that there were some processes going on with oceanic crust to, in fact, drive changes in the elevation of that oceanic crust through time. And if material is lighter, it's less dense, and if we think of an analogy of water, it will float higher in water. Well, geologists had come to realize that perhaps the layer beneath the rigid outer surface of the Earth was in fact a layer that almost acted as a liquid. It's really plastic, but the surface, the more rigid material, was actually floating on it. So what that would suggest was that the areas of the seafloor that are floating higher must be a little bit less dense, the areas of the seafloor that are floating deeper must be more dense. And a scientist who had actually spent the Second World War on board a ship collecting lots and lots of data about the depth of the seafloor, when he returned to the faculty at Princeton, was the one who said, boy, if I look at these seafloor features, the ridges and the trenches, I can almost put together a story of how lighter molten material might rise up in the middle of the ocean basins, and then as it spreads out in the ocean basins, it cools and becomes more dense, and it sinks back down in. And he published in 1962 a paper in which he proposed an idea that he actually called geopoetry. Geologists have come to call it the theory of seafloor spreading since that time, but he had been sitting listening to many of his fellow scientists try to come up with some explanation of some of these processes observed, and he put this forth very tentatively. And yet it really took hold in the geologic community because a whole bunch of other data was being collected simultaneously that led great support to his idea. And in fact, one of these types of data, which is one that's very hard to illustrate and explain in this type of a presentation, we could spend a whole hour on it, was that scientists have been collecting data about the magnetic characteristics of the seafloor. And in combination with studies that had gone on land, they'd come to realize that the Earth's field as we know it undergoes a complete reversal about every million years or so. And on land, in lava flows in Hawaii, they can see this, where there's lava which has the polarity that we see today, and on top of it a layer which is reversely magnetized, and on top of that another one which is normal to today's, and so on. And originally they had thought that there was some sort of random change going on in the rocks, but they began to realize that we could actually use this as a means of establishing a chronology or time scale geologically. And what happened was that scientists also realized that when they looked at the seafloor, they could see this same kind of pattern, not perfectly linear, but very regularly spaced patterns of what we would think of in white, black here, they've colored as today's normal polarity to the rock, but bands outside of it that appear to be reversely magnetized, normally magnetized, reversely, and so on. They found these on the seafloor, and at first they made no sense, but with Hess's proposal of the seafloor spreading in geopoetry, all of a sudden this became almost a ticker tape that could explain and record the movement of the seafloor as it moved apart or separated at these ridges. And this idea really became the cornerstone to support this idea of these movements of the plates. Now, a number of other types of data emerged. Drilling in the seafloor coupled with the studies of those magnetic reversals enabled scientists to actually get an age of the seafloor. And what this pattern shows us is the very youngest rocks here in bright red, then getting older as we move away from the middle out through sort of yellows and oranges to reds and then on out into greens and blues. And this gives us a very interesting pattern then in the ocean basins. In the Atlantic in particular, what we see is the very youngest rocks right down the middle and older rocks as we move out to the edges of the Atlantic Ocean. The Indian Ocean is somewhat similar, except we have a three-way system where we're creating new crust and older material going out in three directions. The Pacific is a bit off-center. The youngest material is here and then getting older as we move out into the western part of the Pacific. Some of the other kinds of data that were collected was to simply look at the distribution of volcanoes. If we look at these red dots representing the locations of volcanoes, we find that they're not randomly scattered on the surface of the Earth, but they occur in a fairly regular pattern. And this suggested that something must be happening in these locations that isn't happening out here in the areas where the volcanoes are not found. And similarly, a look at the distribution of earthquakes is very similar. explain the distribution of earthquakes. What makes an earthquake happen? Well, we must have two pieces of fairly rigid material moving past one another. And that all of a sudden then enables us to say, well, where we have earthquakes must be places where these two plates are encountering one another. And so we can use these distribution of earthquakes to then outline the locations of our plate boundaries. And lots of data has been collected since this time. We're actually, using lasers, they are able to measure the movement of plates on the timescales in which we all live, that on the order of fractions of centimeters per year. And we now have all kinds of data that does, in fact, lend us great support in this idea that these continents have moved, and with them, the oceanic crust on the plates has moved as well. What I want to do then is talk about basically the three types of plate boundaries and some of the features that we see associated with them. The first type of plate boundary that I want to talk about is one that we sort of give the official name to as a divergent plate boundary, where the plates are diverging or moving apart. The feature that we see associated with, and this is a ridge, and I'll show that in a sec, but basically, if we look at this map, they are the places where we had these seafloor features rising up from the seafloor, the ridges, and they form what's often described as the seams on a baseball. You can see that there are earthquakes associated with them. And what we have happening at a divergent plate boundary is two pieces of crust moving apart. The illustration here sort of shows us that as if we took a jigsaw puzzle and simply pulled on the two sides of it, we would be tearing apart and sort of leaving a gap here in the middle. These illustrations show us what would happen if we pulled apart a piece of continental crust. What we find is into this space in between, hot molten material from deeper in the earth makes its way to the surface, and as it cools, it forms oceanic crust. Continental crust is formed in a very different way. This kind of hot material rising up chemically is very different from what we find on the continents, and it makes this thinner layer of rock that makes up the oceanic crust. Ridges are fascinating places. For a long time, geologists had speculated that there must be a tremendous amount of heat associated with them because it's this young molten material coming to the surface. But it wasn't until the end of the 1970s that scientists first observed this outpouring of heat at these oceanic ridges. And these are features that I just have a couple slides to illustrate them, but where the hot rock is heating seawater, and that seawater is being almost sprayed out because it's under such pressure from its heat within the surrounding seawater. Chemically, it's different. It carries a lot of dissolved compounds which precipitate out and form these features that we call black smokers. Temperatures can get up to as high as 350 degrees centigrade. Now, water boils at 100 degrees centigrade, so we're talking about very high temperatures. But the more fascinating thing, sort of, to all of us who read about this from afar, is that it supports a whole new community of organisms. Organisms that live no place else on the surface of the Earth. Never before known until the end of the 1970s. These are tube worms. Their life support comes not from solar energy, the way we all live with the solar energy supporting the plants who then support the animals, but their energy comes from the chemistry down there at these ridge systems. These tube worms are about 2 meters in length, so they're great big huge things. Big crabs you can see crawling around as well. Well, just to look at a little bit of some of the ridge systems that exist, the Atlantic, where we have the plates on the western side of the Atlantic separating from those on the east. We have a ridge system that we call the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Most of it is at depths of a few miles down, not where we can observe. But one of the most interesting places to observe a ridge is here in Iceland, where because of an additional outpouring of molten material, you know, sort of a combination of an oceanic island superimposed on a ridge, and it's really the only place in the world that you can actually go and walk in a ridge system and see the evidence of the separation of the plates in the west and the plates in the east. The Atlantic has been opening for about 200 million years. In contrast to that, we have a very young ocean basin forming here in the Red Sea, where the separation here has been taking place for only about 25 million years. But again, as continental material split, oceanic crust formed beneath them. Now, whoops. A ridge system very close to us, which is illustrated in a very different way here, is the ridge system between the Pacific Plate and the small Juan de Fuca Plate here, where if we look at it in cross-section, we have these two plates moving apart. And here at this ridge system, scientists have also discovered this hydrothermal community. You can leave it on, Evelyn, because I'm going to go right back to it. Thanks. This same kind of a hydrothermal system with the tube worms and the various kinds of organisms that are there. But again, these two plates are moving apart or diverging and creating new oceanic crust there. Now, the next type of plate boundary is one that we call a transform plate boundary. And it's one where the blocks are not moving apart, and they're not moving together, they're simply sliding past one another. Illustrated here is sort of as if you took the two parts of a puzzle and moved them laterally, you would end up with some distortion, material being affected by shear in between, but you're not creating any new crust the way we saw in the previous type of plate boundary. If you looked at it in the continental area, you would see features that are offset at this transform plate boundary. And perhaps the most famous of all of these, I'll return to this for just a sec, is the San Andreas Fault, where we have the Pacific Plate sliding past the North American Plate. Not separating, not coming together, but simply sliding past. Moving at a rate such that in about 40 million years, Los Angeles will be a suburb of San Francisco, and the Dodgers and the Giants will once again be crosstown rivals. I can say that to my college classes and they go, huh? This is an aerial view of the San Andreas Fault, and one of the things you can see here is the very linear feature of the fault, but the offset of stream valleys that have been displaced as this western block of material, continental crust, which is actually on the Pacific Plate, is moving northward relative to the North American Plate, which is over here. What that means...
The whole plate's moving.
Yes. Yes. Now that's a complicated thing to envision. They're all moving all over the surface of the Earth. And we talk about that motion in two ways. We talk about it as relative motion, so how one plate appears to be moving relative to another plate, which from our human perspective works pretty well. And if I'm standing in the eastern part of California and watching the western part of California, if I'm looking west, it's appearing to move northward relative to me. But we can also talk about motion in an absolute sense for the Earth. But the problem with that is, what's our framework? Because we aren't in... place, although it turns out that there are a few features produced which appear to stay in a constant location relative to very similar features. These are called hot spots. Hawaii, the islands of Hawaii, having been produced by one. And if we look at some other hot spots, they don't appear to move relative to one another, but the plates move around them. So they've been able to give us a better absolute fix through time. Are you going to say something?
Well, I'm puzzled. The Pacific Plate is moving northward, but you say the North American Plate is moving also laterally southward?
Relative to the Pacific Plate.
Well, yeah, that would have to be relative, but it isn't. It's
relative to Hawaii.
No,
we're moving on the North American plate. We're actually moving at this point, not a whole lot relative to Hawaii, slightly westward relative to Hawaii.
Slightly westward.
But relative to Europe, we're moving westward at a fairly rapid rate. So
yeah.
If we look at Eurasia and North America, they're moving apart this way. But if we look at North America relative to the Pacific, there's this kind of motion.
This action is taking, what's doing at the junction up there with the Juan de Fuca?
Yeah, it gets complicated there. That's why Mendocino, California has a whole bunch of earthquakes.
Right.
Because there's kind of three plates coming together. That's right. The trouble with looking at a diagram like this is we've put a spherical surface on a flat map.
Yeah.
So, in fact, this junction here, which is sort of the North American plate and the Juan de Fuca and the Pacific plate all meeting, really doesn't meet at a right angle. Because when we start putting it on a sphere, it doesn't look quite so dramatically right angle. But it is a very complicated area right there. Just a couple more illustrations of the, in fact, movement of the San Andreas Fault. This is a photograph taken following the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, seeing this very dramatic offset of a fence as a result of this motion. We're standing on the Pacific Plate, that's the North American Plate, and we've moved this way. Today, you can still go and see that offset. You can go to Point Reyes in California, where there's a national seashore, and there's an earthquake walk there within the park area. And you can walk down this path where these colleagues of mine are standing and see this offset between the fence here and the fence there. And with people standing there, it gives you a sense of how very great that movement was associated with that earthquake. Well, now our third type of plate boundary is one where plates come together, they encounter each other. And as again this illustration using a jigsaw puzzle shows, you start moving this material together and something is going to happen here in the middle. Now what that something is going to be determined slightly by the type of material on the two sides. One illustration is this here showing an oceanic plate, oceanic crust, encountering continental crust. The density of continental material is less than the density of oceanic material. So when they come together, the oceanic material and that whole plate actually bend and are subducted back down into the earth and ultimately remolten. I'm going to show you in just a sec another illustration that shows that depending upon the type of crust on the two sides, this isn't always what happens. But this is a very good illustration of the types of features that may be produced. As this plate is subducted, it's heated. The material, particularly that that contains a fair amount of water from the layer of sediments that were on that plate, undergoes melting. That molten material, being less dense, rises back to the surface and produces volcanoes. And that's the Cascades, and we'll return to that in a sec. In addition, as this plate rubs against this plate, this is where we're going to get a whole lot of earthquakes. Earthquakes that actually extend down to about 700 kilometers depth. The third thing that happens is a lot of deformation, as this illustration would suggest. We end up with a lot of deformation of this material right here. Two plates sliding past one another. Material on this plate often gets scraped off and added, building more continental area up here. Lots of folding in the material, lots of faulting in the material there at the surface. Oops. Stepping on it didn't advance it the way I wanted it to. So this is an illustration actually of the three types of convergent plate boundaries. The type we just looked at was that where we have oceanic crust being subducted beneath continental crust. We also have some locations where oceanic crust is coming together with oceanic crust. Perhaps one of the better examples of that is Japan. And what we do is still have one of those plates being subducted, still have melting of material, volcanism, folding and faulting and volcanoes, but we produce not more continental material, but we produce an island that emerges up on the overriding plate. And Japan is just such an island. As those islands build up through time, they may become large enough that they start to resemble pieces of continental material. Now, the third type is where we have continental crust coming together with continental crust. We can't have subduction. Continental crust is too light, it's too buoyant, it does not subduct, and so instead, what we have is a major amount of deformation of the continental blocks as they collide together. As this suggests here in this illustration, perhaps originally what we had was oceanic crust being subducted beneath continental crust, pulling behind it a piece of continental material. Once all of the oceanic material was subducted, then the continental material collided. Perhaps the most dramatic example of this is where the subcontinent of India, that's an interesting slide, isn't it? Well, can you all just kind of flip that in your mind? All right. Where the subcontinent of India was sort of a small fragment of continental material, it traveled northwards behind subducting oceanic crust. That oceanic crust was being subducted beneath Asia, and once this continental fragment came into contact with more continental material, the subduction ceased, but the collision continued. And for the last 20 or so million years, there has been a major amount of deformation of the two continental blocks of Asia and the subcontinent of India, producing tremendous uplift in the Himalayas. So they're the result of this collision and the uplift of material. Very little volcanism, unlike this kind of a convergent boundary that we live on here, but tremendous amount of deformation and uplift of material. Does anybody know what kind of rocks you find, what kind of fossils you find at the top of Mount Everest? Fossils from the deep sea. Again, evidence that something has happened to deform and uplift material that was once down on the deep sea floor.
What kind of new minerals are discovered as a result of that?
Well, the minerals, what we're doing is taking rocks that were deposited as sediments and deforming them. And we actually don't get all that exotic of mineral forming. We get alteration of the rocks. The exotic minerals that we tend to think of occur from processes of a very, very intense deep compression of the rocks or the migration of very hot fluids up to the surface, which is why we have an ore body here. One of the other examples that we have of a convergent plate boundary is the one that we actually live on here. Just to back up a sec. All around the Pacific we have convergent plate boundaries. Japan, I said, is a place where we have oceanic crust colliding with oceanic crust. This island arc is formed as a result of the volcanism. And as we start to look around the Pacific, we can look at a variety of other locations. This is the Mariana Trench, behind it the Mariana Islands, the Philippine Trench, the Philippine Islands, moving on all around here, the Aleutian Trench, the Aleutian Islands. All of these are formed by the collision between oceanic crust and oceanic crust. If we come over here to the eastern side of the Pacific Ocean, we have collision between oceanic crust and continental crust. And the Andes are perhaps the best example to offer up of this, where we have this range of volcanically active mountains because we're subducting oceanic crust beneath continental crust. And this basically continues all the way up through Central America as well. Remember here, what we have is a transform plate boundary. But here, as we come up into the Pacific Northwest, again, we have a convergent plate boundary. And this illustration here just shows us that the subduction of oceanic crust beneath the continental crust here. So the Juan de Fuca plate and the North American plate are here colliding with one another. And we certainly are very aware of that as we look at the Cascade Range here. Here we have Mount Rainier. Hasn't been very active volcanically in the last few thousand years, so we haven't been reminded of it too dramatically. On the other hand, if we move southward, there are others that show us much greater evidence of that eruption. Here is Crater Lake. How many of you have been to Crater Lake? It's a spectacular location to go to. I can't remember what it is. It's about an 18 mile or so drive around the rim of the crater. And basically what we're looking at is a very large volcano that blew its top about 6,600 years ago. And that crater that was left behind when the top blew off has filled up with water. It's actually geologically too large to be called a crater. It's really called a caldera geologically. But that doesn't sound like quite as nice a name for a national park, Caldera Park, so a caldera lake. In the middle of it, though, we have Wizard Island, which has gradually rebuilt as a small little volcanic cone within the larger one. It's an incredible place to go visit, and my husband and I were there very early in the season, actually the first day that they started running boats on a tour within the lake. At this point, you can no longer drive your own vehicle around the rim. They run a bus tour around the rim, and the boat is one that you have to hike down about a mile's hike down to, so it's not something that every tourist takes on, but it's really quite a very worthwhile trip, and you can get off and wander around on Wizard Island as well. But perhaps the volcano which has reminded us most dramatically of the fact that we have the collision between two plates is Mount St. Helens. And this is a picture of Mount St. Helens taken prior to 1980. It was called at that time the Mount Fujiyama of North America because it looked so very symmetrical and perfect as one of these volcanoes, just as Mount Fuji does. A view taken post-1980, but from a very similar location, shows us what Mount St. Helens looks like today. Again, it blew its top, but also blew out the side of the crater so that it won't fill up with water in the way that Crater Lake did. And again, as in Crater Lake, we can see the rebuilding of a cone within the original one. Associated with these convergent plate boundaries are a tremendous number of natural hazards. And that's actually the topic that I'm going to pursue tomorrow, but I've alluded to some of them. I mean, the risk of earthquakes, the potential for the eruption of volcanoes, and I'll come back and spend some time sort of talking about some of those tomorrow, and some of the risks that are inherent in living on an active plate margin or a convergent plate boundary as we do today. So, I have finished what I had planned here for some formal presentation and would love to spend some time discussing this, answering any questions. Turn the lights back on and make everybody wake up. Are there any questions?
You noticed that the earthquake or the earthquakes tend to be also towards the Rockies. Is that part of another system or?
Well, every theory has its flaws. One of the beauties of the theory of plate tectonics is that we can explain so many of the features that we observe. The distribution in general of earthquakes and volcanoes, how we formed ancient mountain ranges like the Appalachians. The Appalachians formed by the collision between the continents on the west side of the Atlantic and the continents on the east side of the Atlantic coming together about 400 or so million years ago, staying united as a single continent and then separating. Maybe less, maybe 300 million years ago. But we see those ancient processes recorded in the rocks as well. But the trouble is we have this one very large mountain range of this continent that doesn't fit into the theory, and that's the Rockies. The western part of North America has a very interesting history. It has been added piecemeal onto the rest of North America. Pieces of small land masses traveling on oceanic plates and colliding with North America and being added on. And there's some suggestion that historically, 100 million years ago, there was a convergent plate boundary with subduction on the west side of North America. And if so, then we could see uplift of a large mountain range. But the trouble is that's the Sierras. That still doesn't explain the Rockies. And geologists haven't come up with any good unifying explanation of the Rockies. But there's earthquakes there, there's activity there, it just isn't a plate boundary in the way that we observe any other plate boundary. It's obviously some internal deformation within a plate, within the North American plate. And those are very hard to explain. But it does remind me that we come as teaching faculty and we're asked if there are books we wish to suggest. I mean, the kinds of things I talked about today are in almost any intro geology textbook, which isn't something I would want to suggest for them to sell in the bookstore. But geology is presented in many ways to a wider audience. And one of my favorite authors, if I may borrow these books for a moment, is a man named...
Wait a minute, I'll pull out the postcards.
Okay. Is a man named John McPhee. And I don't know if any of you have encountered his writings previously. He has written for the New Yorker magazine since the 1960s. And this man has the ability to write about any subject. And what he does is just immerse himself into a subject and into the people who are involved in whatever he's studying. And he has a whole book, not quite as thick as these, titled Oranges. And it's about orange growing in Florida, the people who do it, what the land is like, the geologic history of the land, how oranges grow, what happens to them when they're harvested, and so on. And I've always found his writing extremely captivating. And I got involved in reading him long before he started putting out a series of books about geology. But he has put out a quattro of books, four books that travel across North America on Interstate 80 with four different geologists, going across the Appalachians in a book called In Suspect Terrain. He doesn't spend a lot of time in the Midwest because the geology is pretty simple layer cake there. But the next book is called Rising from the Plains, and it's about the geology of Wyoming, and I'll talk about it in just a sec. It's a spectacular book, but it spends a lot of time talking about the Rockies and some of the theories to explain the Rockies. The next book, Traveling West, is called Basin and Range, travels across Utah and Nevada, and then the final book is called Assembling California. They do have that one over here in the bookstore, where he travels across California. And in this, he talks about all these little pieces that have been added on to North America through time that make up California. The one that I love of this series of four is Rising from the Plains, because he spends the time traveling with the geologist David Love, who is the state geologist of Wyoming, and sort of Mr. Geology of Wyoming. He grew up on a ranch. His mother had come to Wyoming about 1910 to be a school teacher, a recent graduate, I think, of Mount Holyoke. Got on a train, went west to teach in a one-room schoolhouse, met a man who was kind of this big bear of a mountain man who they settled down and had three kids on a ranch, and those kids grew up there and just came to know every stretch of the land. And David Love and his brother both became geologists, but his book, McPhee's book, is an interweaving of his travels with David Love around the state and studying the geology and the excerpts from David Love's mother's diary of her arrival in this wild place at the turn of the century. And so it to me is just a wonderful weaving of stories. But these four books do a wonderful job of presenting to the layperson the geology of North America as one makes this transect across. He's written a number of other books, one of which is called Encounters with the Arch Druid. And the first, well, in this, he goes and travels with a variety of people, sort of often taking an environmentalist and somebody from the other side to an area and going camping for a number of days. And in the first of these, he goes up into the Glacier Peak Wilderness, in the first of what's presented here. And I believe they actually spend most of their time at Lyman Lake. It's been a number of years since I read that one, but up in that area. And they go up, and one of the trips that he makes is with David Brower, who was for many years head of up the Sierra Club, and then, you know, goes and takes somebody who wants to go drill for oil in that area. And they go canoe down a river for a while and say, now what? But in any event, if you're at all interested in reading those kinds of things, I encourage you to take a look in the bookstore at his books. And
what was the first one you named? I didn't know.
In Suspect Terrain. And terrain is actually in that case spelled, well, he refuses to.
He doesn't spell it like terrain?
Well, he does, because he refuses to spell it the way geologists do. Okay. Geologists are using a slightly different word to refer to these pieces of continent that have been added, these terrains that have been added on.
So how does he...
Now I've just got myself confused. He's either spelling it T-E-R-R-A-I-N.
I think he does.
He does.
Yeah, I think he does.
But geologists are trying to use the word T-E-R-R-A-N. To differentiate it from sort of the shape of the land. And then basin and range was the Utah Nevada one. He also wrote a book called Coming Into the Country About Alaska. And it has a lot of geology in it as well, more than many of his earlier books. For anybody who's a basketball fan, he wrote a book called A Sense of Where You Are, and it's about Bill Bradley's career at Princeton as an undergraduate on the basketball team. John McPhee got an in on that because his father was the doctor for the teams at Princeton. His father called him up early in fall of Bradley's freshman year and said, there's somebody you got to see. So he followed him and wrote about it.
I think his control of nature, which is also in the bookstore, is marvelous. Three marvelous case studies of do we control natural phenomena or not. And one of the case studies is based on Iceland. And the new volcano on Heimaey, and did human action actually stop the lava or not? And one is based on the Mississippi River, and do you really control it or not, and all of this. And the third case study is out from California, mm-hmm. in terms of all the erosion or the fires, I forget, just
the debris from
the Sierra Nevada around the land.
I believe is it the Madrid Fault that goes down through the Mississippi River?
Yeah, the New Madrid Fault.
New Madrid Fault.
Yeah.
You kind of skip over that, and I was just wondering about it.
Well, again,
I live pretty close to that. That's why I'm asking.
It isn't one that fits into the plate boundaries that we know today. And geologists believe that it's a very, very ancient fault that is periodically reactivated by the weight of the land mass on top of it and the accumulation of sediments and the water and so on. It's probably a fault that's about 400 million years old. But when it moves in a big way. And in 1810, 1811, they discovered that. It's probably the largest earthquake that the lower 48 states has experienced since white settlement. Geologists don't quite know how to fit that into their pattern of predictions. I mean, we can say that there are certain places that we expect earthquakes to occur. There are other places that earthquakes are obviously occurring, and so we have to say some level of prediction for there. And that area is certainly one of them, but not with the frequency that we would expect in California, for example.
But the severity could be equal.
In part because of the lack of frequency, that the strain which is built up when it's released is very great. I don't know how many of you know of that activity of that fault, but when the earthquakes occurred in 1910, 1911, the course of the Mississippi was actually changed by the severity of that earthquake.
There's a whole new lake in Tennessee, eastern Tennessee, western Tennessee, called Real Foot Lake, which I think is, what, 20 miles long or something like that, where cut off the,
Here about 10 or 15 years ago, we had an action in that, and it just so happened that it was on a Sunday morning, and in our parish, we had suspended lighting, and it started swinging on us, and it was quite an exciting moment.
Yeah, what would be some of the places that you would choose to live if
as a geologist?
Uh-huh.
Well, if I wanted to observe exciting geology?
No, if you wanted to. Because I had just heard a lecture by David Bagley out of Oklahoma, who's really talking about these things, like the East and the West and the Mississippi Delta, really gonna, something's gonna start around 1996. So I was just curious about some places that would be safe, given all the information that's around.
Well, since the Earth is a dynamic Earth, I'm not sure there's any place you can escape. Sure, you can go live in the Midwest, geologically. If you
but
go live in Ohio, that's right. That's right. If you and you go live on the East Coast because there aren't that many earthquakes there, but
hurricanes.
Or you can go live too far south, or you'll have a hurricane every couple weeks. And in fact, a very large earthquake took place in 1755 near Boston, Massachusetts. And again, it's another one like the New Madrid Fault that doesn't occur with the same frequency, but it's a very substantial earthquake when it occurs. So I'm not sure how to give you an answer to that. I guess it depends what risk you want to face and sort of the frequency that's expected. You know, there's a lot of things happening geologically and in terms of our weather, and I'm not sure you're going to escape risk.
Well, the least amount of risk.
I have to say that as a geologist, I didn't pick the current house I live in to reduce my risk. When I talk about some natural hazards tomorrow, I'll talk about mud flows, and I live in the path of a major mud flow a few thousand years ago from Mount Rainier. But I happen to like the house I live in and the town I live in, and I just sort of accepted that when I moved there. I guess I, in an earthquake-prone area, probably wouldn't live on a real steep slope. That's probably... But on the other hand, I know of a man who's an earthquake seismologist who lives on a very steep slope in Western California because he liked that house, so...
How sound geologically is the hypothesis then that the chief influence in the Western United States now, geologically speaking, is the immense weight of shipment of National Geographics?
I think my husband would argue that that plays a large part in our house. I had never heard that.
Hadn't you?
Well, I have heard the explanation that you know, all the loose marbles in North America have rolled to Western California because that section of California is moving, sliding off into the ocean. But of course, it's not really. As I explained,
they have a little out of loose marble.
Yeah, I hadn't heard the one about the National Geographic. It's an interesting idea, though. Other questions? Well, our time is up, but I thank you all for coming, and I'm available for further discussion if people are interested at any point.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
I hope it sparks some interest.
Thank you. Yes.
What town do you live in?
I live in Puyallup.
Oh, okay.
Down in, you know that area, but I live down in the valley, you know, where it shakes like a bowl full of jelly when we have an earthquake. My house has been there since 1920, so it survived the 40. 40-